it has skyrocketed, and for the region, it ranked pretty high. Taking a look at just one of the stats on steel, for example, 1,300 metric tons to 24,520 metric tons. 1,300 during the deposed Shah, and then 24,520 metric tons registered after the Islamic Revolution came. And it goes the same for cement, aluminum, copper. Electricity, 2,300 gigawatts to 312,000 gigawatts per hour. I mean, you know, these types of advancements are pretty remarkable. How is it that the Islamic Republic, through sanctions and through all the restrictions, was able to achieve and advance in the, so incredibly in these different fields that I just mentioned?
Well, yes, indeed. It's quite extraordinary how Iran has progressed, and this has been a sort of a difficult situation for the enemies of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic State, are bewildered that with 45 years of sanctions, a country should have been on its knees by now. But not only has it progressed on all fronts, whether technologically, academically, you know, at this moment, because one of the things that Iran did was really to focus on education. And at this moment, there are 47 Iranian universities, which are in the top 500 universities of the world. So that really gives you a sort of immense picture of what's happening. The other factor to remember about education is that 60% of undergraduates, as you well know, are women in Iran. So again, this nonsense that is talked about in the West, that Iran neglects the female population of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is completely debunked. And then you carry on whether Iran has sort of developed technologically, scientifically, and many, many other fields. Like Ayatollah Khamenei has said that the sanctions have actually been a gift to Iran. Because what has happened is that just like the resistance axis, Iran has been able to build a resistance economy, if you like. For the last, particularly the last 25 years, Iran has had to, as I said, through the education sector, build capacity of talent in Iran, and that has contributed to the growth in many, many sectors. And of course, Iran has been, of course, trying to move away from the reliance on hydrocarbons. Therefore, other industries have developed, just like the drone sort of industry, to take one example, that Iranian drones are now seen to be one of the best and the cheapest produced globally. So again, that could be another export market that Iran could utilize. So yes, of course, sanctions have hurt, there's no doubt at all, but it has made Iran resilient. You know, to use a metaphor, if you throw someone in the sea, they will find a way of swimming out of it and surviving, because this is human nature. And Iran has found an opportunity, with the support of the people living in Iran, especially the younger generation, who have not seen the revolution, post-revolution generation, if you like. They are contributing immensely, because what happens, you know, like Sheikh Soleimani quite rightly pointed out, that Islamic Republic is the center of Islam and Shiism. Today, Hussein bin Ali's base is in Iran. You should know that the Islamic Republic is a century. And if this century is preserved, others will be preserved as well. If the enemy destroys this century, no century, neither the centuries belonging to Ibrahim and Mustafa will remain. So that, I think, is the fundamental issue why Iran continues to survive and prosper. And I am very sure it will continue to sort of do so. And I remember, just sort of, you know, as a sort of interesting anecdote, I remember, you know, vividly the Islamic Revolution, and we had a foreign minister called Dr. David Owen. Labour Party was in power in UK at that time. And soon after the revolution, he comes on BBC and says that, I don't think this revolution is going to survive more than 2 weeks. Now, that obviously has been a dream of the West continuously, that the Islamic revolution will fail in Iran, but it has continued to become stronger and stronger. And of course, you know, the opposition to Iran by Reza Shah Pahlavi's son sitting in USA and organizing conferences in Paris and so on. Again, just before 2020, Mr. Bolton and other leaders from America who gave a speech saying that they were hoping to celebrate 2021 post Islamic revolution in Tehran. Again, they are being proven emphatically wrong in their analysis. So I think the sanctions have proved immensely right. important for the progress of Iran and to make it resilient.
All right, let's bring in Ali Risk. He is a journalist and political analyst who joins us from Beirut. Ali Risk, welcome. So I think I want to come at you with this question as to why it is that we're looking at the, I'm not going to call it a standoff, but a clash of ideals when it comes to the Islamic Republic and the West, in particular the U.S. I think on the U.S. side, if you agree, there has been a deduction from the allies that the U.S. perhaps had, and basically the Western bloc is somewhat in some sort of transformation, and the Palestinian issue has caused a lot of grievances in that regard, or differences, I should say. And therefore, we are seeing people perhaps identifying more with Iran and what it stands for. And I'm using the Palestine issue because we're seeing what's unfolding, this genocide in the Gaza Strip. And, of course, that's one of the core issues of the Islamic Republic, identifying with the oppressed people of Palestine. Is it correct to look at it this way?
Well, I think that definitely you're seeing some very important developments linked to the Global South. Global South, of course, describing mostly the developing nations and the non-white countries of the world. I think this was particularly evident in the case filed by South Africa with the International Court of Justice. So definitely, I think that the non-white world, you know, Asia, Africa, Latin America, those countries, if you look at the way they're pursuing their foreign policy, you can see that they're distancing themselves more and more from U.S. foreign policy. And this doesn't apply, by the way, only to the situation in Gaza. I think if you look at the war in Ukraine as well, it's interesting that many of the of these countries from the global South also didn't join the anti-Russian campaign. So it is true, it can be said that more and more countries appear to be drifting away from the U.S. The latest stance related to Gaza, the Biden administration's all-out support for Israel, this has, I think, greatly eroded the U.S. claims about having a moral authority or being a beacon of freedom, etc., particularly given in mind that you have in Israel the most right-wing government in history. And this, I think, explains to a large extent why the Biden administration appears to be intent now on, you know, trying to bring an end, or trying to somewhat show that it's doing something. If you notice the sanctions which were issued against some leaders of the Israeli settler movement. So, yeah, I do believe that things are changing. I think that things are changing in favor of Iran's worldview, which always expressed doubts and suspicions about the U.S. claim to being the moral actor, or the most moral actor, the actor which has, you know, freedoms and ethics, etc. Things are indeed pushing in an opposite direction.
This whole notion of freedom, particularly freedom of expression, Shabir Rizvi, is something that the West wants to make it appear that it is the flag bearer of. But yet, just days ago, you had the Facebook and the Instagram accounts of Iran's leader be taken out. I mean, this is a clear example of double standards, and that is something that Iran, you know, makes that a point to obviously highlight, saying, "You see, this is what the West does." So when it comes to people who are critiquing Iran, it doesn't quite make sense who are in favor of the West or the U.S. When they practice time and again double standard of certain issues. So the question is, are people seeing the light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to what Iran stands for, what Iran is saying?
Is this question addressed to me, sorry?
Shabir Rizvi, I'm sorry, Ali Rez. Go ahead, Shabir Rizvi.
Okay. Look, what has happened in the last, nearly 120 days in Gaza, and the sort of brute manner in which the genocide is being committed by the Zionist regime. I have stopped calling it a Zionist regime. I call it the Talmudic terrorist who are occupying that part of West Asia. Is very clear that the lies and lies and lies that were promoted by the Zionist regime and the West in support of it, and really sort of echoing everything that comes out of Tel Aviv as truth, people have realized that it is not truthful. They lie, and as I said, it's been a whole history of lying since the advent of the Zionist regime 75 years ago, and even prior to that, using the Holocaust industry to really implant foreigners in Palestine. So that has also given it a factor that the enemies of Iran, when they say something, I think the public here in the West is sort of realizing that how untruthful their media is, the legacy media in the West, and their politicians. Of course, Iran has been portrayed as a rogue state, a terrorist state, a state in which women's rights are not there. So, of course, all those factors sort of made the people think that Iran is an evil nation against humanity. But their public are realizing, due to Gaza and what's been happening there, as I said, that everything that is coming out of the mainstream media in the West is not being accepted as being complete picture. And of course, what is happening with the war in Ukraine as well is sort of showing the double standards of the West, and particularly the media. At the end of the day, it's not only the politicians, but of course the media works in conjunction with the politicians of the West to promote a line which is against the oppressed people. And people are realizing that very clearly. And of course, Ayatollah Khamenei has many times said that soft power is very, very important. And I think the Islamic Republic of Iran needs to do a lot more. But of course, the voices are being silenced. As you quite rightly said, that even Ayatollah Khamenei's Facebook account has been taken down. Press TV has been banned from the UK to operate. RT was banned. Chinese TV. So, of course, they are using all kinds of instruments. But I think, again, the people are not relying on mainstream media. There is ample alternative media that is available for people to really get information, which is more truthful and really sort of representing a view which is totally different to what is being promoted by London, Paris, or Washington.
Sure. Thank you. We do appreciate that. That's Shabir Rizvi, political analyst there from London. We're going to say goodbye to him. Thank you so much for your input. Ali Rizk, continuing with you, we can't not talk about resistance, which lies in different facets of not only Iranian lives, but the Islamic Republic in terms of one of its core tenets. But resistance groups in particular is something that I'd like to ask you about, which has been one of the fruits, I can say, of the Islamic Revolution. Give us your take on it, and particularly the fact that many are under the false understanding that resistance groups are being directed by Iran in terms of how they're carrying out themselves. And that is not the case, where Iran obviously was resisting the Western influence, in particular the U.S., which wanted to obviously have Iran obey to its diktats, but Iran has pushed that and had resistance against that throughout the years and decades. And again, your take on the role of the resistance groups and how the Islamic Republic had a pivotal function towards that.
I think that regarding the claims that that Iran, it is the one which dictates what resistance groups do, I think that even in mainstream media, you're beginning to see some changes. Well-known journalists in websites like Defense One, you know, websites which are considered to be either mainstream or close to mainstream, even they have begun to admit the fact that, or they're publishing from people who admit to the fact that Iran doesn't control groups like Hezbollah, like the Houthis in Yemen, like Hamas, etc., the resistance movements. So I think that this claim has been debunked to a large extent. On the other hand, if you look at the way the United States deals with other groups, some people believe that it's the U.S. which issues its dictates to groups which are considered to be U.S. proxies. So there's an interesting irony involved here. About Iran, about the fact that, or the general role played by resistance groups, I think that the resistance in Lebanon, other groups elsewhere, they found in Iran a party which would be able to put an end, or which would support them in putting an end to injustice and oppression. If you take the example of Lebanon, you had the Shias in South Lebanon who suffered greatly at the hands of the Israelis. They found in Iran the necessary source of support required in order to resist these unjust policies. I think that the same applies as well with groups like the Houthis in Yemen or Ansarullah, and also Hamas, and even the groups in Iraq. You have to remember, in Iraq, it was very important development whereby Iran, under the leadership of the former Quds commander, General Qasem Soleimani, was the first to come to Iraq's aid, even before the United States did, by the way, in confronting that danger, which was indeed an existential danger, not just to Iraqi Shias, but I think also to people of other confessions. You remember the sufferings of the Christian Yazidis, or Yazidis, if you recall Mount Sinjar, the events over there. So Iran has played a very important role in countering a danger which was considered to be not just a danger to the region and to certain religious sects or confessions, but a danger to the whole world. ISIS attacks reach different parts of the world. So this is where we can see the importance of the role played by Iran, a supportive role, you know, in collaborating and providing this as necessary kinds of assistance to those countries that either face oppression or face existential terrorist dangers, or face both at the same time, which can be applied to many countries of this region. This policy has borne fruit, by the way. If you look at the Middle East right now, we can indeed talk of a new Middle East. Yemen has become a resistance, not just a resistance group or resistance movement, but rather a resistance nation. If you look at the speeches by Abdel Malik al-Houthi and the massive turnouts coming out, both to watch, to be there in this, listening to the speeches, and also the mass protests. Hezbollah's strength, Hamas's strength, as we saw illustrated in the October 7 events. So a new Middle East has come into existence, which is capable of countering both Israel and the United States. And I think that is a big development, and Iran has played a pivotal part in bringing about this new situation.
All right, let's bring in Habiba Jaghouri, journalist and activist from Adelaide, Australia, who joins us. Welcome to the program. We're talking about resistance groups, and I want to ask you, given the fact that the Islamic Republic has supported resistance groups, has enabled them in one form or another in order to go after their ideals, which somewhat parallels what Iran is after, why do you think that, first of all, that is the case, and why do you think that this has resonated with many people around the world, groups like Hezbollah or Hamas or other resistance groups that are after, not having their independence taken, and standing up for the ideals that the Islamic Republic, for example, has.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. Firstly, my heartfelt congratulations to the country Iran, to all the revolutionary people, all the people inside of Iran for the 45th anniversary of the success of the Islamic Revolution. When I hear that the Islamic Republic supports resistance groups, I hear that the Islamic Republic supports human rights. I hear that the Islamic Republic supports the struggle for liberation and freedom, justice. I hear that the Islamic Republic supports sovereignty, self-determination, and countries and people deciding their own fate away from the US and the Western hegemonic and imperialist agendas. I think that there is so much resignation between these because people are growing tired, people are oppressed by their governments. The working class realizes that their rights are diminished and that the government cares more about plundering other countries, cares more about profit, cares more about war and weapons, rather than sustaining their people, rather than advancing their own working class. So people are tired of this, and people have the right to resist, people have the right to protest. The oppression that is going on around the world, especially in occupied Palestine by the State of Israel, thanks to the backing, the diplomatic and military support of America, people can now see that there's oppression, there's a fight, there's a struggle for oppression, and there's a struggle for justice. And they see that Iran, because of their revolution, the success that they had by eliminating America out of their region, out of their country, and by gaining self-determination, have gained hope that this is a possibility for them as well. Hence why these resistance groups have sprung, and hence why there is so much mass popularity with them, with the public.
I think risk taking a look at what the U.S. has been reduced to, and I'm somewhat at fault here for making the conversation turn into the U.S. vis-a-vis Iran, but we've seen how much the U.S. has stood against Iran and acted against Iran, but so be it. The U.S. has been reduced to, in some countries, having to convince the country that it needs to stay there, such as Iraq. Now there are talks with the Iraqi government on how it's going to transition out of the country, or for it to illegally be in a country like Syria. Why is it that the U.S. pursues that policy where Iran has said it is a source of instability in the region, which is a very well-known fact, hence showing how what the U.S. has been reduced to when it comes to its presence?
Well,
this is for Ali Risk. I'm sorry. Ali Risk, go ahead.
Indeed, U.S. policies, whether it be deliberately or not deliberately, have brought about havoc in the region, starting first and foremost with the George W. Bush administration entering Iraq, you know, under the pretext of weapons of mass destruction, and then the policies in the aftermath, as I said, whether deliberately or non-deliberately, brought about great dangers, including the emergence of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, led by Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi. We saw also what happened in Libya. Look how the situation over there has deteriorated greatly. So the U.S., its militaristic policies have brought about great damage to the region, and it has been a source of instability as a result of the approach which it has taken. At the same time, the U.S. accuses Iran of promoting this instability, which I think is a bit ironic, or whatever you want to call it. Maybe it reflects a kind of hypocrisy. U.S. enmity towards Iran, by the way, I think is greatly rooted in two factors. Number one would be the arrogance of the U.S., which does not like to see any independent country which has its independent policy being successful in the region. And I think a second element, which I believe is even more important, is the outright U.S. support for Israel. The U.S. presence in countries like Syria and to a lesser extent in Iraq, this stems greatly from protecting Israel. They often refer to the Beirut-Damascus-Baghdad corridor, that land corridor, U.S. troops based in Syria, one of their main missions is to prevent that corridor from being established as an act of service for the Israeli side. And I think this just shows you how much the Israelis indeed have a large sway or have a great influence and domination over U.S. policy in the region. I'm not saying that that's the only factor in U.S. policy in this region, but it certainly is a major factor. And I think that one of the very important conclusions which we can draw from this current war in Gaza is how much the Israelis can indeed pursue policies and how much control they have over the U.S. foreign policy. One of the major reasons why Biden, for example, isn't taking firmer action to stop the Israeli genocide is domestic political calculations, in addition to the fact that he himself is a strong supporter of Israel. So these pro-Israeli policies, I think, they do play a very, very important role in the United States pursuing a policy in the region, which in the end, I think, backfires against the U.S. itself. I think that the U.S. has lost a lot of influence and a lot of credibility in the region because of its pro-Israeli tilt. So, you know, had the U.S. behaved differently, I think that its situation would be in, you know, a lot different than it is today.
Well, the Islamic Republic, taking a look at some of the things that it has done, when we take a look at the wars, Habib Ajiguri, it doesn't want the world to forget when it comes to, let's say, Yemen, where 400,000 Yemenis died. They were killed as a result of the war. This is the war that was backed to the hilt by the U.S., for example, when it comes to military sales. Or the war in Afghanistan, where so many died. And the Islamic Republic wants to make sure that the world doesn't forget the foreign policy adventures that have led to so many deaths that were either led by or supported by, in whole or in part, by the U.S. There's other different theaters, where the U.S. has played a destructive role. Which theaters stands out in your mind?
The theaters that the U.S. has played in a destructive role, I can think of every single colonized country, and I can take it back to the U.S., starting from the U.S. itself, which is a country that is built on the genocide and enslavement of its native population and the enslavement of slaves that they brought in from Africa, as well as stealing their resources. There was a recent study that was done, and it concluded that Africa is owed trillions of dollars in reparations from the wealth and resources that it had been stolen from by the U.S. and by Europe. The U.S. is a global evil power. It is global arrogance. When the leader of the Islamic Revolution and the fighter of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, came and declared America as the Great Satan, Shaitan al-Akbar, this was a vision. It was an understanding that the role that the U.S. plays in the world is to completely suppress all humans to a system, that this system will control the way that they live their lives, their thought processes. It's a system of colonization, not only of your land and your political and economic system, but of your mind and of your culture. We brought Yemen in as an example. Yemen suffered 8 years of blockade. The UN had declared it the world's worst famine by Saudi Arabia, by the US. And it was Iran, through their dealings with Saudi Arabia, that after 8 years, the blockade was lifted, and now it is Yemen that is playing such a pivotal role in fighting U.S. aggression in the Red Sea, that is playing such an important role in disrupting production, that has caused countries such as Australia and the U.K. and U.S. to retaliate on its civilians. The Islamic Revolution gave people the torch of hope, and it gave people the pathway towards dignity, towards self-determination, and to decide your own fate, to not be subjugated to systems, but to be free and liberated people who can decide what your country should do, who can build democracy, and who can be all about people power. Right now, the situation in Gaza is an example of the evil atrocities that the U.S. is willing to commit to remain in power. Israel is nothing without the support of the U.S. Israel is a sinking ship, and so is the U.S., and that is all because of the inspiration of the Islamic Revolution that is being spread out worldwide.
Ali Weska, the way that we're looking forward now, given the fact that 45 years have passed, in terms of the path that Iran has taken, it obviously is still on its alert when it comes to the U.S. and its destructive activities against Iran. But it has found some major allies that the U.S., through its, destructive moves against countries like Russia, like China, has put them into the corner along with Iran, and they have united. And because of that, it somewhat has involved other countries coming into that, a corner and that spot with Iran. Do you think that we're looking at the fact that the U.S. and some of its allies are now outnumbered when it comes to the world as a whole, in terms of countries uniting, coming into one block, let's so to speak? And the one that I think of are blocks like, for example, BRICS, how we're seeing so many countries wanting to join it, which obviously is not a good sign for the U.S.
Before I answer the question, just a quick comment on the somewhat malign American activities or actions throughout history. The U.S. indeed does have a history of pursuing some very malign, evil actions and policies. One very important example is the U.S. policies in Latin America, what they call the American backyard, how they used to support death squads in places like El Salvador, Nicaragua. Latin America, hence, has a very, very bitter history with U.S. policy. The United States remains the only country to have used an atomic bomb, bombing Hiroshima. And the Middle East later on got its own taste of American destructive policies, as we saw in places like Iraq and Syria. So there is an evil history, if you would like, on the part of the United States, although there have been some sane policymakers, but often they've been overruled by the more insane people or the more irrational actors in the U.S. political establishment. Regarding your question about the allies, that's a very important question, by the way. I mentioned the Global South in a previous question, but I think it's not only about the numbers. I think you have to look also about the power and the weight of the countries that are coming to form the anti-Western bloc. You can talk about now China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and indeed some Latin American countries like Venezuela, for example. South Africa, as we saw, is more and more tilting in favor of that other anti-Western bloc, particularly after the case made with the International Court of Justice, the complaint made against the Israeli side. So you do have a non-white, if you would like, anti-Western coalition which is coming into existence, and I think that this poses a severe challenge for the United States of America. And I think that the war in Gaza, by the way, has given a source of motivation to further speeding up this for the formation or the establishment of such a new coalition or such a new world alliance. So we have entered, I believe, the multipolar world. I think that the United States is facing fierce competition. Look at what China did, for example, in its Middle Eastern role, how it was able to mediate the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think that did cause a lot of alarm amongst the thinkers or the decision makers in Washington, because they indeed came to believe that now the United States is facing a new player which is emerging in the Middle East. And that came after Russia also played a role in Syria, whereby it, along with Iran and Hezbollah, it assisted in fighting the terrorist groups over there and assisted the Syrian government. All of these, I think, are new characteristics and new developments that we are seeing a new world order which is emerging. And in this new world order, I think the Middle East also is exhibiting some new trends, and some new players are now beginning to establish themselves as forces to be reckoned with.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to say goodbye to Ali Risk, but Ali Risk, thank you. Journalist and political analyst there from Beirut with your input. Let's continue with you, Adelaide, if we can. Taking a look at the representation that Iran has, which is in a variety of fields that it's leading the way, but obviously it does have Islam as its religion, and it advocates many different things that are that Islam offers. And in terms of what it wants, it doesn't preach in order for people to just want to convince people to follow that path, but it shows what Islam is all about through its eyes and how that can be applied to different world matters. I'm talking very generally now, but because it's the Islamic Republic and it's its anniversary, I'd like to find out from you what stands out for you in this case.
What stands out for me, given what the revolution has achieved and what the revolution has manifested for the people of Iran and for extension the world, is the notion of women's liberation and what that means and what that looks like. Prior to the revolution's success and during the time of the Shah, women did not have access to education. They did not have access to resources that anyone would deserve from their own land, because the land's resources was being sold out to foreign entities. So women were subjugated to very, I would say, restrictive ideals, and not having access to education was something that stunted their growth as spiritual and physical, mental, emotional human beings. The Islamic Revolution came and showed women that they can be fighters on the street, that their place is in the revolution, that their intellectual participation in society, that their spiritual, scientific, emotional, physical participation in society is all not only needed, but valued, appreciated. It is what would make society run. Now Iran has women in STEM dominating the field of STEM. Women are in government. Women are providing for families. They are running households. Women are achieving and winning gold medals in Olympic sports. Women are creating art and creating music. This would not have been the case if the Shah's regime had continued. It is absolutely excellent for me to witness the women of Iran to be the forefront, revolutionaries in terms of dignity, in terms of justice, science, politics. I love that. This is what the Islamic Revolution gave. It gave the woman the respect and dignity she deserves to participate in society. It gave her the safety that she needs to participate in society. That is one great success that I can attribute to the Islamic Revolution. There are many. Another I can attribute is that Iran's scientific advancements, despite its sanctions, despite the brutality and hostility of the Western state apparatus media, Iran has achieved a lot in terms of its scientific progress, whether it be uranium, whether it be creating and innovating its own cars. No other country can do this with such harsh conditions, but the Islamic Revolution gave people hope. It gave people determination to continue, and Iran is flourishing. So it's excellent for me to witness. It's excellent for me to witness that 45 years on, there are mass demonstrations in support of their government. There are millions of people that come out, millions upon millions, to declare their pride for their country and their respect for their revolution and the revolutionary leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It's brilliant. You do not witness this anywhere else in the world. You do not witness it in Australia Day. There is so much division here in Australia with Australia Day. But in Iran, there is one message, and that is dignity, that is pride, and that is resistance.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. Habiba Jaghouri, journalist and activist from Adelaide, Australia. We're going to say goodbye to you, but thank you for your input. Let's bring in Sabas Rohilabresvi, activist and political analyst, who joins us from Qom. Sabas Rohilabresvi, welcome. Congratulations on the 45-year anniversary. When you take a look at this Islamic Republic's progress and challenges, I should say, and the 45 years that have now it has put behind it, entering its 46th year, where do you see the most important achievements that it has made that has really contributed to the progress of this country?
Salam and peace, and my congratulations to all in the audiences, all those who are watching Press TV now currently. Of course, the most important achievement that Islamic Revolution did, from my perspective, is the role model that it presented. And the point is that this country with the role model, and by role model, I don't mean that it is not anything wrong. There are so many problems in everywhere. But at the end, a role model which is functioning for 45 years has been presented by this revolution to the whole people of the region initially, and to the people of Volt, of course. And that's the most important part of the story of the Islamic revolution. That's something that's igniting and pushing others, because a role model has a social effect on other nations, because it's showing a path to others that there is a way out of this situation. And if you want to bring a bold example of that role model, is what the Islamic revolution of Iran did for the Palestinian cause. And we are all amid this crisis currently, and I do want to return back and review what Iran has done for the revolution of Iran has done for the Palestinian cause, which I believe is the revival of the Palestinian cause. It was the 1979 revolution of the people of Iran and late Imam Khomeini, who revived once again the Palestinian cause. And let's not forget, when this revolution took place, it was January 1979, just 6 months after the agreement of Camp David. 6 months before this revolution, Egypt, the biggest and the most powerful country of Islamic and Arabic world, signed Camp David and surrendered, actually, in front of the Israelis. And Anwar Sadat traveled to Israel to occupy lands of Palestine and delivered a message, delivered a lecture in Knesset of Israel. And for everyone, that was a full stop for the Palestinian cause at that time. But no one was expecting that within 6 months, a revolution is going to take place in some other part of the world, not in Arab countries, but in Iran. And this revolution is going to be the key support, is going to be the crucial support, is going to be the backbone of the Palestinian cause at regional level, international level, and global level, of course. And that's what Islamic revolution of Iran did. And it brought a new role model when all the solutions of the Arabs and the Muslims were useless, and everyone was thinking that there is no more hope for the Palestinian cause. Islamic revolution of Iran did it initially by supporting the Palestinian cause politically. We all know that the first Palestinian embassy was started just a few days after the revolution of Iran, and we all know that the first international delegation that traveled to Iran, which was led by late Yasser Arafat, who was the Palestinian delegation, who traveled a long way, and they all came to Tehran and they all congratulated the Iranian revolution. They met with late Imam Khomeini, they met with Sayyid Ahmed Khomeini, the son of Imam, and they went to the Palestine Square in Tehran, which is now where the Palestinian embassy is located, and they took the key of the ex-Israeli embassy and they turned it into the first international Palestinian embassy. This was the Islamic revolution of Iran that gave a platform, a political platform for the Palestinians.
Listeners, here we wrap up the live coverage of the occasion of the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic revolution in Iran. Again, on behalf of all IRIB English radio staff, I extend my sincere congratulations on the occasion of the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic revolution of Iran.
Yes, we congratulate all our listeners on the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic revolution. And this has been our live coverage of the 11th of February rallies and marches. We now go back to our regular programming. Stay with us. Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 11th of February, which this year marks the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. This decisive and momentous day in Iranian history is marked every year by rallies and marches commemorating the epoch-making days of February of 1979. According to the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, the Islamic Revolution was an explosion of light. Today, 45 years later, the Islamic Republic is going from strength to strength. Congratulations to all of our listeners.
Islamic Revolution, Prelude for Imam Mahdi's Emergence. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. The struggles of the Iranian nation to overthrow the despotic, dependent Pahlavi regime underwent many ups and downs to gain victory. However, the arrival of Imam Khomeini on February 1, 1979, breathed a new spirit in the soul of the nation, and the struggles were seriously accelerated so that, within 10 days, the revolution triumphed and the end of the dictatorial rule was officially announced on radio and TV. Nearly 1.5 months later, a nationwide referendum was held in which over 98% of participants voted for establishment of a ruling system on the basis of Islamic values. The new system was called Islamic Republic of Iran. In those days, very few could guess what effect this system would have on the domestic and global developments. Yet, the great leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, from the very beginning made it clear that the movement of the Iranian people was indeed setting the ground for the universal movement of the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi, and his auspicious emergence, inshallah. In the final episode of this series, which is broadcast on 11th of February, the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we will further touch upon the issue. Stay tuned, please. It was quite obvious that Imam Khomeini and the Iranian nation were in pursuit of materialization of Islamic teachings in society and the ruling system. But with regards to the hostilities and obstructionism of the United States and other Western regimes, some persons and groups believed that the Islamic Republic would have a short life, which would not allow it to fulfill its promises based on the Islamic laws and teachings. Nevertheless, people wholeheartedly supported the revolution under the guidelines of their wise leader. Thus, the system, despite engagement in separatist plots, assassination of officials and laymen by terrorist outfits, economic sanctions of the United States, imposition of the 8-year war and other schemes, not only survived but also turned into a sturdy and robust tree after 45 years. Imam Khomeini and his rightful successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, have made it clear several times that we are just moving in the course of establishing the Islamic rule, and there is a long way to cover to reach the lofty goals of Islam and full realization of the divine goals, which will be feasible only through the universal uprising of the Redeemer of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Imam Khomeini said on this, "A revolution is the starting point of the great revolution of the Islamic world under the banner of Hazrat Hujjat Imam Mahdi. May God favor all Muslims and the world people and ordain his emergence in this age." The Islamic Republic of Iran has proved that its policies and plans, both inside the country and abroad, on the basis of the Islamic ideals and the ideals pertaining to Mahdaviyat, the belief in the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. It is quite clear that Western regimes deem the spiritual values preached and proclaimed by Iran as a big dam ahead of their unholy desires and interests. Therefore, they do their best incessantly to hinder the way of spread of this enlivening breeze. Interestingly, there are some narrations from the Prophet of Islam and his Ahlul Bayt, which refer to the movement before the global revolution of Imam Mahdi, which will act as a prelude for the Imam's revolution. For instance, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, named some people who staged an uprising from the east and set the ground for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. Numerous hadiths point to a man who carries the banner of struggles from Iran and finally joins Imam Mahdi. Yet, a very noteworthy hadith from Imam Musa Kazem, the seventh infallible successor of the Prophet, reads in this regard, "A man from Qom invites people to the truth. People gather around him like parts of iron. Storms of events do not make them tremble, and they do not get tired of war. They are not scared, and they trust in God, and the end is for the God-weary." This hadith bears high resemblance to the features of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini. He started his movement from the city of Qom, and the brave people gathered around him and followed his cause. The outward awe and pomp of the Pahlavi regime and the unflinching support of the United States and many corrupt governments for the regime couldn't shake the resolve of the Iranian people, and they successfully toppled the despotic regime and set up the Islamic rule instead. The Iranian people, with trust in God, pursue the materialization of Islam in every aspect and seek to continue the revolution till the universal revolution of the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. The 45-year practice of the Islamic Republic proves that it follows the goals and values mentioned in the hadith regarding the movement and government of Imam Mahdi. Imam Mahdi's first measure will be to fight oppression and injustice with obliteration of corrupt rules. The Islamic Republic, too, has also shown opposition against injustice and dominance in words and deeds. That's why many people in other countries have learned this lesson from Iran. Establishment of justice is another feature of the rule of Imam Mahdi. To materialize this lofty ideal is very hard, but the Islamic Republic has exerted its utmost in this direction. Ayatollah Khamenei, pointing to the occultation of Imam Mahdi, says, "For 1,000 years, the Islamic Ummah has been praying for fairness and justice. Upon its emergence, this Islamic system's first job is to execute fairness and justice. Fairness and justice are the most obligatory jobs. We want even welfare for fairness and justice. However, the leader is not satisfied with the measures taken for removal of discrimination and believes that the move towards the great ideal should be faster. The support for the deprived and trying to solve their problems is another feature of the global government of Imam Mahdi. The Islamic Republic, too, has taken a lot of measures to remove deprivation and poverty with creation of welfare for them." The officials of the Islamic Republic have made great efforts to spread the Islamic values similar to the time of Imam Mahdi. Today, the Iranian people manifestly show their love for the Redeemer of mankind as they try hard to prepare the ground for his reappearance, despite all barriers created by the front of arrogance led by the United States and the equally wicked regime Israel. The renowned experts of Islamic studies and great teacher of seminaries, Ayatollah Abdullah Javadi Amoli, writes in his book, Imam Mahdi, The Promise Being, the precious Islamic revolution led by late Imam made it quite clear that with a small number of people, one can stage a deep uprising and grand movement against Taghut, rebel, and rebellion. With awakening of dormant hearts of men, make them accompany oneself, and through elimination of the rebellious system, witness the sunrise of the divine and Islamic rule.